This show is produced by the Hartman Media Company. For more information and links to all our great podcasts, visit hartmanmedia.com.
Welcome to the Flashback Friday edition of the Creating Wealth Show with Jason Hartman. As he rapidly approaches 1,000 episodes of this podcast, he has handpicked individual episodes that he feels is going to be good review for you to prepare you for the future by listening to the past. Let's dive in.
Welcome to the Creating Wealth Show with Jason Hartman. You're about to learn a new slant on investing, some exciting techniques, and fresh new approaches to the world's most historically proven asset class that will enable you to create more wealth and freedom than you ever thought possible. Jason is a genuine self-made multimillionaire who's actually been there and done it. He's a successful investor, lender, developer, and entrepreneur who's owned properties in 11 states, had hundreds of tenants, and been involved in thousands of real estate transactions. This program will help you follow in Jason's footsteps on the road to your financial independence day. You really can do it. And now, here's your host, Jason Hartman, with the complete solution for real estate investors.
Thank you so much for joining us today. Today, we're going to talk about landlording, long-term investing. We have a conference call for our monthly call coming up on the self-management details of how to properly self-manage your properties, even from a long distance, as you've heard me talk about on prior shows. I've had very, very good luck with that. And that will be the subject of our call, which you can register for at jasonhartman.com. It is $20 for non-members. And if you're a member in one of our membership programs, it is free. So make sure you take advantage of that. And by the way, speaking of the website, we have had the past 6 or 7 days some tremendously horrific website challenges. So I do apologize if you visited any of our websites. We have had some pretty big problems. I'm not sure what's happened. We still have not figured it out, but we may have been hacked. I'm not sure. And we're working on that. So if you ever need to reach us and the web becomes undependable for any reason, feel free to call us. Our number is 714-820-4200. That's 714-820-4200. And we've had problems from time to time with the websites, but boy, this has been a tough week last week with the website. So we're trying to get it back on track, and hopefully that will come to its fruition very soon and we'll be up and running at full capacity again. But the show runs off a different server, so the show should be getting to you just fine. And speaking of shows, we haven't had much time to publish a lot of shows lately. We've been just incredibly busy since the Meet the Masters event, and want to thank all of you for coming out for that. It was a tremendous success, and we've planned our next one for October, here October 2011, and another couple people just registered today, and I got to tell you, I am so pleased and impressed to see so many of you registering for the event so early, and of course, you're getting that fantastic early bird pricing of about $250, which just can't be beat for the event, so thank you for registering so early. It helps us make our plans, and you get the benefit of that great low, low pricing. The other thing I want to talk to you about, well, we've got two guests for this show, actually. We've got Doug coming up here, and we've got another guest where we're going to talk about landlording and some of the legal challenges on landlording with an attorney and author. But before we do that, I just closed on another property I purchased, an apartment building in Scottsdale, Arizona, and we are doing so much business in the Phoenix area right now, the greater Phoenix metro area, that we have decided that we want to do our very first real estate tour. And this tour would be slated for the middle of May. We want to do it pretty quickly because, of course, it gets hot in Arizona, but it is a dry heat, as they say. And we want to do that in mid-May. And we've got some good group pricing on hotel rooms at the ultra-swanky Ritz-Carlton, of all places, Ritz-Carlton Phoenix. So we'd love to hear any of your feedback on that. You can give us feedback by just giving us a call or going to the website, jasonhartman.com, and putting any comments you have in the contact us form or on our Facebook page. If you go to Facebook and look up Platinum Properties Investor Network, we're thinking the cost of this tour with accommodation, with everything but airfare, basically. We'd either cover all or most of your meals. We'd cover the hotel at the Ritz-Carlton, so it'll be absolute first-class accommodations if we end up going with the Ritz-Carlton. We are in negotiations with them now, and it'll cover the cost of the transportation around town to look at the properties. So we'd rent the buses and so forth. And all of that, we're thinking this would probably land somewhere around $700, maybe $799. And the only thing you have to do is get yourself to Phoenix. And other than that, pretty much everything else would be all-inclusive.
Remember, you're listening to Flashback Friday. Our new episodes are published every Monday and Wednesday.
So let us know any feedback you have on that. Again, it's our first tour, and we haven't really done tours before, but we want to do that, and we want to do a Dallas tour in the fall. So would love to hear what you think about that. So without further ado, we'd like to really make this show on the focus of landlording and long-term investing. And I have Doug here with me to talk about that today. Doug, how are you?
I'm doing great, Jason. How are you?
Well, good. How are things up in Portland, Oregon?
They're nice and gray and rainy right now, but it's April, so that's what happens.
Well, April showers bring May flowers, right?
That's what they say anyhow.
It's really sunny and nice down here in Southern California today, but I'm glad you wanted to be on this call, Doug, because I think I made a little bit of a mistake at the last Meet the Masters event by getting people a little too excited about flipping opportunities. And I have done a few flips over my investing career that spans over 20 years now, but I've made most of my money. I've made millions of dollars with the long-term investments. And flips are great when you can do them and make some quick money. That's pretty good. You do get beat up on taxes pretty well, as you're going to talk about. But the problem with flips is I haven't been able to really duplicate them. That last one I did was in Indianapolis. My profit before taxes is hovering right around $25,000. And I just closed on the sale of that property, purchased it about 3 months ago, just resold it and closed on it. So I'm glad to say that. But boy, I've been trying to buy some more, and I just can't find any more to buy where I have a comfortable enough profit margin to do a straight out flip. Now, listeners, Doug, might be asking, you know, what's the difference? Well, if the property is a good deal, it's a good deal no matter what. No, not so quick. If you're flipping the property, you may not really care as much about the location, the neighborhood, and really the long-term potential of the property. Where you're buying and holding it, it's a different criteria in that respect. But what are your thoughts on the duplicatability of flipping and also the tax aspect? Because even though I made that 25 grand, which was nice, gosh, I'm going to give half of it to Uncle Sam, aren't I?
Well, so where do you think you want to start, Jason? The duplicatability or the taxes? Because they're very different topics.
Well, let's start with taxes, life's single largest expense for anybody listening.
Okay, so the first thing to consider is that when you flip, as you said, you're going to pay full price on taxes. So let's just let the listeners think for a second that whenever you flip a property, that falls into current income taxes, which means you pay the current normal income tax rate, which tops out at 35% for the feds. And if you're in a state like Oregon or California, is going to nick you for about another 10% on the state. So you're talking about 45% the maximum hit. So you could lose up to half of whatever you make right off the top from taxes.
And I will, because being in the Socialist Republic of California, I'm hit with the state tax plus the federal tax, and it's all ordinary income tax rates, where if you get hit on tax with a property, you'd be crazy to do it, because you can always 1031 tax deferred exchange them when they're the buy and hold type properties. But even on one of those, if you should get hit on the tax and not exchange for another property, then you can at least pay the lower long-term capital gains rate in the worst case scenario, right?
Exactly, yeah, because the federal cap gains rate tops out at 15%. So let's say that you're in California or Oregon and you pay 15 plus 10, that's still 25. You know, your max hit is 25% versus, say, 45%. Or if you can do a 1031 exchange, you can defer your gains indefinitely. So from a tax perspective, yeah, flips really don't do you any favors tax-wise. Now, of course, the advantage offsetting that is that you see your money right now as opposed to an income property, which is where you see your money in a compounding cash flow stream over time. But for somebody whose investment horizon is relatively long, that compounded cash flow stream can be really advantageous. Because if you figure you buy a property, you're getting rent, you pay your mortgage, you have X amount left over. Well, every year that you hold on to that property, you're presumably going to raise the rent a few percentage points. And since your mortgage is fixed, you're going to see your net continue to go up every year. Well, then at some point down the line, you'll probably sell it and then rebuy something else. If you're smart, you'll do a 1031 exchange when you buy that new property. And then what'll happen is you will theoretically, you'll start amplifying the number of holdings you have. You either change one big property into multiple smaller properties or multiple smaller properties into bigger properties. But what'll happen is you'll start having more and more bigger deals as you're trading appreciated properties for something else, say that has more units or that has units with higher rents or something like that. And so with an income property portfolio, what you do is instead of having a transaction where you make one lump sum of money right now that pays a maximum tax hit, what you're doing is you're taking a regular residual growing cash flow that's highly tax optimized over a long period of time. And you know, of the two, if I'm talking a time period that's more than just this year, I would much rather have that long-term cash flow than a one-time cash hit.
I think the flips, I mean, they're great and they make for great infomercials. And our competitors, we don't have very many competitors, but there are a few out there. They're always promoting this type of quick buck mentality. And it's great when you can do it, but I liken it to the mythological sirens where the sailors heard the siren song and they had to tie themselves to the mast of the ship so they wouldn't crash onto the rocks.
Putting wax in their ears.
Yeah, wax in their ears, exactly. And fortune can reverse very, very quickly when things don't go right on a flip. When you buy and hold for the long-term investment potential, I just find that it's safer, it's more stable, really is just a much more of a sure bet type of thing. Any other thoughts, duplicatability, scalability, anything on that vein?
Well, there's a couple things to think of in that regard. The first is that if you think of the market conditions that are necessary for a flip. So in order to have a successful flip, you need to have a market where you're able to buy below market value, somehow add value to the property to where you can sell it at that market value and have the total be low enough to where you can make a profit. So just by simple math, that situation can't last forever because eventually what's going to happen is if flips are attractive, people are going to be attracted to flips. They're going to start bidding up the price, and then eventually all the profit's going to disappear from people bidding the price up so high. And that's what's happening in Indianapolis right now because you said you can't find any more flips because most of the stuff that you're finding, the price is getting bid up because people have seen there's flips available, and so you know now they're trying to go in for the quick buck. The quick buck artists bid up the price, and then all of a sudden it gets really hard to do the turn and flip. The other thing to consider is that flips are very overhead intensive, meaning that you have to manage the buy transaction, you have to manage the rehab, you have to manage the sell transaction. You know, there's a lot of paperwork and a lot of coordination that's involved with doing flips. And it can most certainly be worth your while. But the thing that we're really trying to do as long-term investors is really create mailbox money, which is to create a portfolio of assets that send us money every month with a bare minimum of effort on our part. Because when you figure that if you have to spend 30 hours a week managing all your flips, well, you have another job. And it may be a well-paid job, but it's another job where you may make a lot of money. That money may suddenly dry up. And either way, you're having to spend a whole bunch of time managing it. I mean, if it's something you can do, you have the opportunity to do, it may be something worth going after, but it's not something that's really smart to base your financial future on. What you really want to base your financial future on is owning those assets that create passive income.
Just a reminder, you're listening to Flashback Friday. Our new episodes are published every Monday and every Wednesday.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. And when you said overhead, I thought you were going to refer, Doug, to monetary overhead, but the time overhead is pretty intensive. And you know what it really makes me think is that every business looks so simple from the outside. And flips are a business. That is a business with a lot of moving parts, and there's just a lot involved in it. And any business can be lucrative, but it's a business, and that's what people should understand. And our local market specialists in various markets, I mean, they're basically, most of them, are flippers to one extent or another. That is their business. But they have offices, staffs, companies, corporate structures, and a lot of resources. And again, if you want to open up any business and you go into it like a business, hey, it can be great, but just understand it has complexity, moving parts, and it has a network of people, a team, and a network of resources you must be able to coordinate and facilitate.
And one of the other things to consider also for any of the people listening who are potentially catching flip fever is that most of the local market specialists who are flippers don't make all that much money on each of the properties they flip, because in order to sell their, in order to move their inventory quickly, they have to discount below market price. Just like how platinum clients who want to do flips, if they want to sell that flip quickly, they're going to need to discount below market price, which will, of course, compress their margins. Now, the reason why most local market specialists do their flips below market price is because a lot of them own property management companies. So what they'll do is they'll set up a deal, they'll sell it to you where they make a small profit, but you get to buy something below market price, and then they'll be able to set up the management. And so then...
And that becomes their annuity or their mailbox money.
That becomes their annuity. Yeah, that becomes their mailbox money.
Right. Yeah.
And the thing to consider is that the people that do flips for a business, in order to turn their inventory, have to discount the properties. As a one deal at a time investor, it's potentially dangerous if you want to just walk into the flips against the professional investors, because they're probably going to be undercutting you on price.
Well, and all of the people listening that want to do buy and hold investments get to take advantage of that. Because see, one thing that a lot of people don't really understand about developers or rehabbers, and rehabbers or flippers, whatever you want to call them, our local market specialists, are in many ways, they're the same as a developer that develops real estate from scratch. It's just a lower degree of development is all it really is.
Well, a lot of it right now too is that there's no money in being a developer right now.
Not from scratch. No, when you can buy below construction costs, there's no money in it at all. But that's another topic. What I did want to say about that though, Doug, is that what people listening have to realize is that there is a virtue and a bottom line profit benefit to turning their machine quickly rather than milking the last dollar out of a deal. So to your point about the way they discount, and our clients get to take advantage of that because it benefits them because they're getting the property at a good price. If they can move their machine faster and turn their inventory faster, there's a lot of money just in that. So that's why our clients see the benefit of getting these discount price properties.
Yeah, and that's one of the things to consider is that, you know, if you think you want to go into the flipping business, you're going to be competing against the professional flippers who buy wholesale, you know, or who basically buy for extremely low prices and sell it wholesale versus somebody like me who would buy wholesale and then sell retail.
Exactly. Well, hey, those are some very good points. Thanks for coming on and talking about this. I know that after the Meet the Masters event, we might have given some people flip fever. And I'm not saying it's bad. I'm just saying it's hard to duplicate because now we've got a lot of people and their expectations are way up there and they're all focused on flipping and they think they're going to get rich tomorrow. And largely that doesn't really happen in real life that way.
Well, yeah, and another way to think about is that you can also consider doing, you know, what I like to call long-term flip, which is say, where what you do is you buy something that is completely appropriate to be an income property, say, and hold it for 1 to 2 years and just wait for a little while until you flip it. So now, are you going to get the fast cash right away? No, but at the very least, you only get stuck with cap gains. And in a best case scenario, you might be able to do a 1031 exchange. But the thing is that you'll be protected because if it turns out that the market price isn't as high as you thought it was and you'd have to discount it excessively in order to sell it, you can just hold on to it.
Yeah, right. Because you've got a stabilized property. So either way, you're going to win the game. And by the way, I have to mention about winning the game with long-term properties, we are finally starting to see some real strength come back into the rental market. And ideally, everyone listening would raise their rents 4% annually. Now, I think we're just starting to move into the time where we can see that happen, because on our conference call last week, where we talked about taxes and so forth, that was our member conference call. There was one article, and I actually put it on our Facebook page for Platinum Properties Investor Network, that talked about how tenants should renew their leases now because they could see rent increases as high as 10%. Wow. And one of my properties in Austin, Texas area, I just raised the rent on that one by $30 a month. It went from, I think it was $11.95 to $12.25. No problem whatsoever. So we are seeing some signs of real strength in the rental market now, which is great. And I know that a lot of these things investors have had to wait because of the financial crisis. All of the predictions I've made are pretty much coming true. They just took a 2-year sabbatical, I think, with the financial crisis. So they're definitely coming true now, though. Any thoughts on that, Doug?
Yeah, the thing to just remember is that if you really want to win long term, that it's the buy and hold investors that are really going to be in the most advantageous position from the long term, especially people that are buying right now, just because your total cost of ownership right now is probably the best it's going to be in our lifetime. And by total cost of ownership, I mean the combination of financing and market prices. Because at some point in the near future, it's very likely that rates are going to go up very significantly. And that could drive prices down even lower than they are today. But what'll happen is your mortgage payment will probably be higher. Because even though you'll be buying on, say, a 5 to 10% lower price, you'll be paying an interest rate that's probably almost double what it is right now.
Yeah, no question about it. And that doesn't have to necessarily even come from appreciation in the price. You're talking about the mortgage aspect of it, but I just want to talk about what we really hit on heavy at the last Meet the Masters event, which is what we call regression to replacement cost. And the reason I bring that up, Doug, is because you just sent me that email this morning about the commodities price index or the Turner Construction Cost Index.
Yeah, the Turner Construction Cost Index. It's up. I think the Q1 11 forecast is out, and I think they're forecasting just about a 0.7% increase quarter on quarter. But the thing that's important to remember about that is that if construction costs are going up, then that's a leading indicator of replacement costs going up, which means that at some point in the near future, demand is going to bottom at some point in the future, and then it's going to start growing from wherever it bottoms. Well, when it starts growing, there's going to be no new inventory on the market. If almost zero new houses being built right now. The only building permits that are being used right now are building permits that have been flipped in bankruptcy. So the person that originally took out the developer that took out the building permit went into bankruptcy. Somebody else bought it at a discount, and now they're building a home for about half of what it costs at the peak, so they can afford to sell it for cheap. That's the only construction that's happening right now.
Yeah, and when you say only, you're saying that as a figuratively. I mean, of course.
But apartment buildings are doing pretty good right now.
And I tell you, Doug, back in 2004, I was always saying it's all about housing, 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 much more so than retail or office space. People have to have a place to live. And of the commercial real estate sector, apartments are the darling of that sector. I mean, they're doing quite well now in the midst of some very, very challenging times for other segments of the market. And I just want to close with the idea, because we've got to get to our guest interview and talk about landlording. And she's an attorney and author. And you know, I think if attorneys were involved in everything, no deals would get done, would they, Doug? Because they're all about being super cautious and putting the brakes on things, right?
Well, the thing you have to remember is that, you know, attorneys are trained to see everything that can possibly go wrong with any deal. That's what they're trained to do. They are trained to see every humanly possible way that any deal can go wrong.
Hey, but in every silver lining, there is a cloud.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. So, yeah. So, you know, as with all things, when you're talking with the sales guy, you need to take it with a grain of salt. When you're talking to the attorney, you need to take it with a grain of sugar.
Somewhere in the middle is the reality of the situation, right?
Exactly.
Yeah, absolutely. Exactly. Well, just remember on this flipping subject, folks, as I've always said, and I've just seen it happen over my career for many years now, the people that flip the properties, they have spending money. The people that buy and hold have real wealth. And hey, spending money ain't bad, but real wealth is a lot better than spending money. So keep your eyes on the long-term prize of the buy and hold investor. And with that, let's go to our guest. And I just want to mention one more thing before we go. Give us some feedback on that Phoenix tour. It's coming up pretty fast. So we do need to know what you think about that. If you'd like to come, if you'd like to participate, we'd love to have you. And that'll be a really fun event, really first class too. And if anybody listening needs a cash partner for deals, I am wanting to buy up every piece of property practically in our network right now that I see come across my desk. The deals are so good. So I'd be happy to be a cash partner with you. So express some interest, raise your hand, let me know if you're interested in that, and we can explore that further. Doug, thanks so much for joining us today and sharing some of your thoughts on the flips and so forth.
Not a problem.
Appreciate it. We'll go to our guest here in just a moment.
You know, sometimes I think of Jason Hartman as a walking encyclopedia on the subject of creating wealth.
Well, you're probably not far off from the truth, Penny, because Jason actually has a 3-book set on creating wealth that comes with 60 digital download audios.
Yes, Jason has that unique ability to make you understand investing the way it should be. It's a world where anything less than 26% annual return is disappointing.
I love how he actually shows us how we can be excited about these scary times and exploit the incredible opportunities this present economy has afforded us.
We can pick local markets untouched by the economic downturn, exploit packaged commodities investing, and achieve exceptional returns safely and securely.
I also like how he teaches you to protect the equity in your home before it disappears and how to outsource your debt obligations to the government.
And the entire set of advanced strategies for wealth creation is being offered at a savings of $94.
That's right. And to get your Creating Wealth Encyclopedia series, complete with over 60 hours of audio and 3 books, just go to jasonhartman.com/store.
If you want to be able to sit back and collect checks every month, just like a banker, Jason's Creating Wealth Encyclopedia series is for you.
It's my pleasure to welcome Janet Portman to the show. She is an expert who has authored several books on landlording. And one of the books that we're going to talk about heavily today is Every Landlord's Legal Guide. We'll discuss leases, deposits, fair housing laws, repairs, rent, privacy, terminations, disclosures, various state laws. And she has written under the Nolo Press banner. And you've probably heard of Nolo. I've used their website extensively. They've been around for a long time. Great company. And Janet, it's great to have you on the show today. Welcome.
Thank you very much.
So let's talk a little bit about what landlords need to know, especially in today's somewhat treacherous economic climate. I'm sure we have seen more tenant defaults and problems with people paying their rent nowadays because these are just tough times out there. And my statement there is somewhat anecdotal. I don't have any specific stats on it, but I just know it from experience. What are some of the things that landlords really need to know about when screening tenants? Maybe we'll start there.
Okay, that's a good place to start because that is actually the most important part of any landlord's business, is choosing the tenant. If you make a mistake, then you're setting yourself up for all sorts of problems down the line, which can not only harm but actually destroy your rental business. So it pays to spend a lot of time screening carefully, and that begins by knowing what questions you can ask and what questions you can't ask. And what I'm talking about here is fair housing. You talk to any landlord who's been in the business for any length of time, he or she will tell you that fair housing is the elephant in the corner. If you make a mistake with a fair housing issue, you are likely to either face a complaint from a fair housing group or a lawsuit from a disappointed applicant. On the other hand, if you don't know which questions you can ask without fear of legal problems, you won't get the information you need to choose the right tenant. So the most important thing is knowing what you can ask in the fair housing context.
Right, right. Janet, I think the fair housing laws are very easy to obey and comply with, and this should not be an area that a landlord ever has a problem with, in my opinion. And believe me, they don't want a problem with this one because it's rather serious. So what are some of the things landlords can and can't do as far as fair housing?
Well, they can certainly ask any question that has a legitimate business motivation behind it, such as, what is your current income? Will you give me the names and contact information of your current landlord and your employer? Landlords can ask for credit reports. They can even ask for more detailed reports called investigative background reports. What they can't do, actually, though, Jason, and sometimes this is pretty surprising to many people, and it's not that easy to know. They can't ask questions like, are you two married? In many states, they can't ask questions like, what are the ages of the children who will live here and what is their gender? They can't ask questions like, this is a adults-only community, are you comfortable with that? They can't even do things that they might think are actually well-intended, such as, I see that you have children, I think you would be more comfortable in this particular area of my property. That's called steering. And even though the landlord might think that it would be better for the kids to be on the ground floor, for example, they can't do that. So some of the questions in a fair housing context, you're right, are obviously ones that are easy to learn and avoid. Others are surprisingly not intuitive, and that's why landlords need to spend a little bit of time learning what the law is.
I have to confess, I have never heard that you can't, I've never done it myself, I don't think, but I've never heard that you can't ask the ages of the kids. That's sort of an interesting one.
You wouldn't want to do that because you wouldn't want to suggest to your applicant that that is a factor in your decision-making. If it becomes a factor in your decision-making, it gives the applicant, perhaps, reason to think that you may be discriminating on the basis of their family. Now, in fact, in this example, suppose you turn them down because they simply don't earn enough to just to pay the rent. They may think that once they answered your questions about their family, that your real reason had to do with the age and sex of their kids. The fact that it didn't is not going to prevent them from complaining and maybe resulting in an investigation of why you turned them down. In other words, you never want to give anybody a reason to think that your decisions are based on anything but sound and legal business reasons. That's why you don't ask about the kids. Mm-hmm. You simply want to make sure that the rental is big enough for the number of people, but the age and sex of the kids is none of your business, and you don't want to give anybody an opening to claim that you use that as a basis for a rejection.
Yeah, that's interesting. So name the protected classes, if you will. Obviously, race, religion, familial status, maybe you want to go into that one a little bit because we sort of just talked about it, and all the other classes. And then maybe talk a little bit about the more complex or newer ones like sexual orientation. That one I think is a big one, but the other one is weight, obesity, and things like that. Is that a protected class now?
Well, it is in some states, but somewhat indirectly. It is not under the federal guidelines or the federal rules. But in some states, and in particular California, it may well be. Now, in California, we have an old Supreme Court case, but it's still good law, that prohibits landlords from using what's called arbitrary discrimination. And arbitrary discrimination has been held to cover things like refusing to rent to people with long hair or beards, men with beards. It really, in its classic form, it means refusing to rent to somebody whose personal characteristic or trait is the reason that you turn them away. So, for example, somebody who is obese, that's a personal characteristic or trait. If you had a rental policy, either explicit or not, that said, I won't rent to overweight people, you could very well be violating California's ban on arbitrary discrimination.
That's interesting to know. I suppose like tattoos or piercings would fall under that even,
right.
Huh? Yeah, okay.
Absolutely.
All right, okay,
yeah.
Good. So landlords need to be careful again. These things are easy to obey, but...
Not so easy. No, I have to tell you.
Well, I think they're easy once you
so
know
easy.
About it. You just got to be really smart. But tell me where landlords mess this up maybe. And tell me about sexual orientation. Is that a protected class now?
It is in California and in many states, but not under the federal laws.
So the federal law is the most lenient, I guess we should say, and then some states add to the federal law
and make it more stringent. Yes,
and
some cities within states become even more protective.
Wow.
Now, to get back to your original question, the federal rules under the Federal Fair Housing Act prohibit discrimination on the basis of race or color, religion, national origin, gender, age, familial status, which includes pregnancy and having children, and physical or mental disability, which also includes recovering alcoholics and people with a past drug addiction. Now, again, I would say to you, those aren't so simple.
That you're right. Those aren't so simple.
They're not.
Yeah.
They're not.
Interesting. Janet, one of the other issues, especially in southern states or states that border Mexico, what about legal status? What about immigration status? I mean, this is all over the news nowadays.
The federal position on that is that being in the United States without permission, namely without legal status, is not a protected class. It doesn't fall within any of the protected categories that we just enumerated. And from a federal point of view, it's not illegal to ask an applicant, can you show me that you are in the United States legally? However, California is a huge exception to that. It is not legal, period, for a landlord in California to inquire about legal status. And there are significant penalties if a landlord does. Certainly, Arizona does not have that protection, nor does Texas.
Right.
California does. We also saw in years past, these statutes have pretty much gone away. We saw several cities, starting with the city of Hazleton in Pennsylvania, not a border state, attempt to pass a local ordinance that would penalize landlords. I think they would face a fine and actually lose their business license if they rented to people who were in the country illegally. That was struck down as a impermissible attempt to enter the area of immigration law, which the federal government occupies exclusively. And there were about two dozen other states which had, or I'm sorry, two dozen other cities that passed similar ordinances, a few in California, including the city of Escondido. Uh-huh. None of them have survived, but it was an attempt on the local level to basically make it impossible for people who did not have legal status to rent in those particular cities. And as I say, they were either withdrawn when the legal landscape became very clear, or they were thrown out by the courts.
Let me take a brief pause. We'll be back in just a minute.
Now you can get Jason's Creating Wealth in Today's Economy home study course. All the knowledge and education revealed in a 9-hour day of the Creating Wealth Bootcamp, created in a home study course for you to dive into at your convenience. For more details, go to jasonhartman.com.
What about advertising your rental property? You want to make sure in the ad, obviously, that you comply with fair housing and that you're not saying things like family area or perfect area for singles or something like that, right?
Right. You don't even want to say things like near the Catholic Church.
Good point.
That may in fact be true, but what you're doing is sending, perhaps, a subtle message that you want people of the Catholic religion and not others to apply. Now, that would be a conclusion that would maybe be reasonable or not. The problem is that if you say that and someone decides to challenge you on it, you may ultimately win, but you will have spent a lot of time and trouble fighting and defending yourself, so you want to avoid even getting entangled in any kind of a claim.
Very good point. What else about advertising the property besides fair housing laws?
Well, you want to make sure from a practical point of view that you give enough information to whoever's reading the ad that they will self-select and not bother you.
Right.
I mean, it's a delicate balance to reach the market that you really want to rent to and not exclude people whom you might ultimately want, and at the same time, make sure that you don't get deluged with people who aren't suitable and who just take up your time.
So how do you do that? Yeah.
Well, you want to certainly give the rent. You want to explain what the amenities are, if any. You want to make sure that if your rental is in an area that has great shops and restaurants, that you mention that. You want to make sure that if the town has an outstanding school system, you mention that. You'd want to make sure, for example, that if you are near a major employer, you'd want to highlight your proximity to that employer. And if that employer has a housing office in which they help their newly arrived employees find housing, you'd probably want to work with them. And the same would go for a university.
So you want to self-select, because you get a lot of calls in these rental ads. So it's good if they self-select and you tell a lot about the property in the ad. Of course, keeping in mind fair housing laws and making sure you don't step over those.
And you want to make sure that you state the deposit, which can be quite a bit of money these days. Most states limit the amount of deposit, but it's not uncommon to ask for twice the monthly rent. And in many states, that's perfectly legal. When you add that to the first month's rent, we're looking at several thousand dollars in many cases. And if you require a deposit of that size, you should say so that people who don't have it aren't going to call you and take up your time.
My understanding, at least with California, I believe, although I haven't dealt with this directly in years, is that an unfurnished property, you can have the first month's rent plus 2 months is the highest allowable security deposit. And then if it's furnished, I believe it's, although I've never rented a furnished property, it's 3 months' rent, right, as the security?
That's correct. And if by chance your tenant has a waterbed, it's hard to believe too many people still have them these days, but you can add another half month's rent to the deposit in either furnished or unfurnished.
That's interesting. Can you do it with a fish tank or anything like that?
No.
Okay, just a waterbed.
Right.
And what about in other states? Do those vary a lot?
Yes, they do. Some states don't set a limit at all, and when that happens, the market will limit what you can ask for. If you ask for much more than a couple months' rent, you just aren't going to get people, because that's just too much money. And some states specify only 1 month's rent. It's important to know what you can ask for, and of course you can find out by looking at the 50-state chart in every landlord's legal guide from NOLO, which gives you that precise information.
Excellent. Well, I had one tenant who applied to me. I remember this many years back, where he had just recently declared bankruptcy, and he wanted to pay me the rent like 6 months in advance. Not a security deposit, but advance payment of rent. Can he do that? Can I accept that?
Jason, it depends on the state. Now, was this by chance in California?
Yes, it was.
Well, California specifically does allow that. It allows the landlord to collect up to 6 months' rent in advance. Honestly, I'm not sure whether the statute was written with this situation in mind, but I do know that it's written in a way that makes it legal for the tenant to make the offer. I'm not sure it's legal or it was intended to allow the landlord to make the demand. But in California, there is a specific provision allowing a tenant to do that. But you know that there's another way that situation could be handled that would be certainly safer for the tenant, because suppose the tenant puts that amount of money, gives that amount of money to the landlord, and then after the second month, the landlord lets the place deteriorate or there's some major habitability problem that the landlord doesn't deal with, and the tenant is entitled to leave and wants to leave. If he does leave, he's got to sue to get his money back. I mean, giving you 6 months' rent in advance puts a lot at risk. The better thing to do would be to put that rent money into an escrow account in a bank with instructions to release it to the landlord on the first of every month.
Yeah, that definitely shifts the power in the landlord's favor in that situation, no question about it. Hey, what do people need to know about renting a property that's still occupied? Can they show it? Can they gain access? What I've done sometimes over the years is I've just sort of bought the tenant's cooperation, saying I'll give them a rent reduction if they help me lease it to a new tenant. Sometimes I've seen it written into leases in advance that upon their last 30 days of occupancy that they'll agree to cooperate with showings of the property. And I'm sure this varies state by state.
You need to do both. You need to find out what the rules are in your state for access to rental property. And many states are very, very specific. They specify how much notice you have to give, when you can enter, and for what reasons. And in California, in fact, there's even a separate set of rules regarding showing it for the purpose of selling or renting to new tenants. So the first thing you need to know is what the structure is in your state. After that, there's absolutely nothing wrong with saying, within this structure, I appreciate your cooperation. I know it's a hassle for you to have people coming in. And to compensate you for the aggravation and annoyance that this will cause, I will reduce your rent by a certain amount. That is a very smart thing to do, because there's nothing more like the kiss of death than to show prospective buyers or tenants a property that has resentful people living there already. What gets communicated is, you know, not the nice granite countertops, but the message is this landlord is a pain in the neck to deal with, and you're likely to lose those prospects. So what you need to do is both. You need to know the law in your state for entering occupied property, and then you need to put on your street smarts hat and get the cooperation of your current tenants by compensating them for the aggravation of traits into their house.
What should people know about dealing with tenants and accepting and rejecting applications?
The most important thing to know is that if you have ordered a credit report or a background report, but most people are really just dealing with credit reports, and if you decide to reject somebody based in part or wholly upon what you read in the credit report, you have to send them a federally required notice called an adverse action notice. It has to have specific language in there appraising the tenant of the basis for your decision and where they can get more information. We have such a form in every landlord's legal guide, and it's very important that you follow that rule and send that letter if the credit report played any part in your decision to reject or impose a higher rent or increase the security deposit or do anything negative with respect to that client.
I've always said that landlords should keep all the applications they receive from a tenant. And some people just kind of throw them away. Hopefully they're shredding them because they've got confidential information on them. And they only keep the application of the tenant they've accepted. I believe that the best practice is to keep all applications in that file, right?
Wrong.
Wrong? Oh, really? Oh.
No, there's
well,
no,
oh, I is it because...
Take a look at every landlord's legal guide.
You know what?
There's a federal...
I know what you're
going to
say. Yeah, I didn't think of that.
It's called the Federal Disposal Rule.
Mm-hmm.
Good or not, that's what it's called. And employers and landlords are required to get rid of material like applications and credit reports when they are no longer needed. Now, that, of course, raises the question, at what point are they no longer needed?
Right.
Quite arguably, the tenant you rented to 5 years ago, who's been gone for 4 years, is not likely to be a part of your business life ever again. Mm-hmm. And you not only need to get rid of his file, you need to do so in a way that will ensure that it can't become the subject of identity theft.
Right, yeah.
Shred it, or if you have all that information on your computer, you need not just to delete it, because we all know that deletion is never really deleted. You need to use a program that will wipe the disk. It's very important that landlords know about that rule and constantly go through their files and get rid of information that's no longer needed.
Yeah, you know what? Yeah, I would just want to tell you where I got that from. I remember years ago, I used to be a member of the Apartment Owners Association, and they said, keep all applications. But this was before the big movement on identity theft and privacy and all of that stuff. It was really before that all came about. And their thinking was that if you turn down a tenant, you should be able to produce or at least refer to that application and say, look, these were the reasons, and you should write notes on the application as to why you didn't accept that tenant.
Well, that's true, but disappointed tenants have only, under federal law, 2 years in which to bring a lawsuit. So once that statute of limitations has passed, there's really no reason to keep it.
Do people, Janet, insulate themselves from a lot of these problems when they hire a property manager? I mean, I know the law of agency, but the nice thing is it puts a third party in between them and the tenant. So they're not making any statements to the tenant, and they're not asking their manager what is their familial status or anything crazy like that that would make them discriminatory. Talk to us maybe a little bit about using property managers and how that impacts the whole thing.
Well, the value of a property manager from a liability point of view is not so much that you've got a firewall, because oftentimes you don't. The law of agency and principle is very, very tricky. You might think that because you've turned the whole show over to a management company, you've got a firewall, and you might find yourself in particular situations sadly disappointed. The real value in terms of liability is that you've got somebody else's insurance policy to respond if something that the management company does blossoms into a claim or a lawsuit. If you pick the right management company, they are insured. You yourself should be insured so that any unpleasantness that follows from what the management company has done or not done is at least handled by your insurance companies. In the end, you know, who actually ends up paying the judgment or the settlement? As I say, it's not always very clear that you have protected yourself by hiring somebody. But it really doesn't matter that much if you've got a policy that's going to pay.
So you've got their errors and omissions or professional liability insurance. That's what you're referring to, right?
Right.
Anything on finder's fees for people that are not using a manager and they're wanting to get some help in renting the property? What I've seen a lot of times is people will use like a handyman that they have a good relationship with and have the handyman put up some signs for them and maybe help them find a tenant and kind of that kind of thing and pay them a finder's fee. Is that legal to do that? I've never really known the answer, but I've heard about people doing it.
Yeah, it is legal. You're basically paying somebody to find you, you know, a client, a tenant. Where it sometimes gets tricky is sometimes there's an attempt to provide that the fee will be clawed back, so to speak, will be forfeited if the tenant turns out not to, for example, honor the terms of his lease, you know, by breaking it and leaving early. In other words, landlords get a little greedy in the sense that they say, okay, I'll pay you this fee, but only if everything works out. And of course, you know, the person who's done the finding may not have done the screening, so how is your handyman going to know that this person has a background that you didn't check out thoroughly and the person ended up being a bad tenant? So that's where things get tricky. But there's nothing wrong with paying somebody to advertise and bring you somebody. I think as a responsible landlord, you have to realize that at that point, whether you rent to him, this applicant or not, is your responsibility and not something that you can put on the shoulders of your finder.
Right. And so that finder, that maybe handyman or whoever it is, doesn't have to have a real estate license or anything like that, right?
Right.
And you can pay them $200 or something to find you a tenant, right?
I think so. I mean, there are states that require management companies or resident managers to have either a license or be working directly under the wing of a licensed person. But if you're really just talking about doing nothing but bringing me an applicant, I doubt that that would fall within those rules.
What about cosigners? On the subject of having a cosigner, I find this a lot in student housing type of properties where the student goes away to college. Student rentals can be extremely lucrative for landlords because the rent-to-value ratio is very high in some cases. And the student that's renting the property, they are harder on the property. There's more maintenance to consider usually. But they also don't have any credit usually. They're just a new adult and they don't have a credit report, and people worry about them being flaky, and they want to get their parents to co-sign the lease. And a lot of parents are more than willing and understand that it's fairly normal to co-sign. But if they do co-sign, can you really hold them to it?
Well, if you've done a proper co-sign agreement, yes. The one in every landlord's legal guide is inclusive, and it does the job. The important thing to remember as a landlord is that if you've got a parent who lives in New York and the kid is going to school in Arizona, you're not going to be able to easily go after the assets of that parent in New York unless either you're willing to go to New York to serve them with papers for the lawsuit, or you've done what we do in every landlord's legal guide's agreement, which is to make the child the agent for service of process for the adult.
Oh, how interesting.
That's a little lawyerly trick.
Yeah.
You didn't mention at the beginning of my introduction, but I am a lawyer, and that enables you to serve the child, which brings the parent into the lawsuit, and then they do have to respond, or they will find themselves with a default judgment against them. So that's one way to deal with an out-of-state parent. The other thing you would want to make sure about is that the out-of-state parent actually is worth something. So you would need to, in a sense, screen your cosigner, at least financially, as carefully as you screen your tenant. You'd want, for example, tax returns. If that parent doesn't have any money, they're not going to do you any good, even if you can.
Right. But I do have to really compliment you. That agent of service little lawyerly trick there you just mentioned is absolutely brilliant. Thank you for sharing that. That's really, really something good. So cosigners, you can check their credit report, and they sign the lease and then sign this addendum that you talked about, right?
Right. They agree to be financially responsible for the consequences of or financial consequences to the rental.
Let's talk a little bit about the bad side of it. And I just have to comment that in 23 years of being a landlord now myself, I find that people really overplay some of the bad sides of it. But it can happen. And you're the attorney, so you're obviously the careful person and the one that doles out all the caution as you should. But let's talk about evictions and maybe about collections after evictions too. When things go wrong, what should a landlord do? How do they do it? They serve a notice, they can hire an attorney service to do this. What should they know about that part?
Well, if the rent hasn't been paid, for example, or the tenant apparently has a dog and the lease says no pets, the first thing they need to do is contact the tenant. And if the tenant isn't willing to immediately pay the rent or get rid of the dog, the first step in any eviction process is service of a notice, a legal notice that tells the tenant that if they don't pay the rent or get rid of the dog within the legally specified amount of time, and it varies by state, that the landlord will proceed with an eviction. Landlords who don't take that necessary first step and go right to court will find that they'll have to start all over. They'll waste a lot of time and money. What landlords also need to keep in mind is that in almost every state, when they actually get to court, their case is going to be put ahead. It's going to jump the line of all the other civil cases, almost all the other civil cases. It's going to go through much faster than a personal injury case, than a contract dispute between businesses. And that's intentional, and it's legal. It's what enables them to get into court quickly, although it may seem rather long if the tenant fights it, but it's certainly much, much faster than any other civil case. Now, the thing they need to remember, though, is that the price they pay for that expedited trip through court is that they have to follow their state's rules very, very precisely. And if they don't, they're going to have to stop and start all over, which is why it's very important to start right by serving the termination notice according to law and then handle the eviction correctly. If they live in California, they can use Nolo's book on how to file an eviction, which has all the forms with instructions. There is no such book for other states, so most landlords in other states are going to have to hire an attorney. But the price they pay for a fast trip through the court is that it's a very tricky and complicated process.
Janet, this has been some great advice. Thank you so much for sharing it on the show. What would you say to wrap this all up and tell us where people can learn more?
Well, people can learn a lot about the landlording business at www.nolo.com. That's the website of my company, Nolo Press, and there you'll find lots of free articles on all sorts of issues important to landlords. You'll also find sample chapters of the landlord and tenant books that I've written. You'll see the tables of contents, the forms, and you'll see great descriptions of the books that we've talked about today, Every Landlord's Legal Guide and First Time Landlord. And it's been a pleasure to talk to you, too. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Janet. These books are great. Everybody go out and get them. They need to be in your library. Appreciate having you on the show, Janet.
You're very welcome.
Jason provides an extremely unique service, Deal Evaluator. Are you interested in a property outside of our network? Need a second opinion? No problem. Let our experts evaluate the deal. Find out more about it at jasonhartman.com. The price is only $50. This show is produced by the Hartman Media Company, all rights reserved. For distribution or publication rights and media interviews, please visit www.hartmanmedia.com or email media@hartmanmedia.com. Nothing on this show should be considered specific personal or professional advice. Please consult an appropriate tax, legal, real estate, or business professional for individualized advice. Opinions of guests are their own, and the host is acting on behalf of Platinum Properties Investor Network, Inc., exclusively.
Thank you so much for listening. Please be sure to subscribe so that you don't miss any episodes. Be sure to check out the show's specific website and our general website, hartmanmedia.com, for appropriate disclaimers and terms of service. Remember that guests' opinions are their own, and if you require specific legal or tax advice or advice in any other specialized area, please consult an appropriate professional. And we also very much appreciate you reviewing the show. Please go to iTunes or Stitcher Radio or whatever platform you're using and write a review for the show. We would very much appreciate that. And be sure to make it official and subscribe so you do not miss any episodes. We look forward to seeing you on the next episode.